Hey, CE Plan members from CE Impact, this is Game Changers. With me today is our resident clinical conversation expert, Jeff Wall. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
How are you today?
Not too bad.
Good, yeah. Good. Well, before we get started, I actually have a fun fact to share. This episode is being released on May 20th. So if you're listening on the day it's released, it's Monday, May 20th. And did you know, Jeff, that our first Game Changers podcast was released almost exactly 4 years ago on May 22nd, 2020?
Wow. Yeah. I did not know that. And I'm sure the number of podcasts then that were on COVID compared to the number of podcasts now that are on COVID were is probably a little bit different. But yeah, no, that's good to hear. It's been 4 years. And I mean, certainly I've heard from people who listen to the podcast who've gotten back to me, email, in person and stuff, that I think a lot of people do find this informative and helpful, you know, and they're able to translate all this stuff to the bedside. And apparently I'm not incredibly irritating. So that's always nice too. So yeah.
Not even close to irritating. So interesting to listen to. I mean, maybe the only irritating thing is people can't listen on 1.5.
I've definitely heard that from several people. They say that this is literally the only podcast they can't listen to it at faster speeds because I talk too fast. I don't know.
It's okay. It makes it interesting. So I love it. Yeah. And funny that you say that. So the first podcast was on hypercoagulability in COVID. So we started in the middle of COVID and which is ironic because last week our topic was COVID too. So here we are still talking about it 4 years later, today. 4 years later.
Yes. No, nope. Yep.
Yeah. Well, we have thousands of listeners now. So I think that's really cool. This has been one of the more fun things that we do, I feel like. And I feel like it's really a great way to learn. I am always learning from you and from all of our guests. So thanks for sticking with us. And
not at all.
Celebrating our 4-year anniversary. It's exciting.
I agree. And it's been fun for me too. And, you know, it forces me to learn too. You know, we're doing research for the pod, and, you know, I got to dive in
and no better way than to teach it.
Exactly. Yeah. Correct. Yep. So,
yeah. Well, let's teach us today. We're talking about the management of acute pancreatitis. So I'm going to let you take it away.
Sounds like a plan. So this is one for my inpatient homies, as it were. Today we're going to be talking about the brand new American College of Gastroenterology guidelines for the treatment of acute pancreatitis. Again, for the inpatient pharmacists listening, inpatient providers listening, we all know this is something we see all the time. I don't think that there's too often on one of my services that I don't have at least one patient with acute pancreatitis. I currently have one poor gentleman on my service with this, and you know, again, it just, you know, we see this literally all the time. So it's always nice when ACG decides to update these guidelines. It's been a few years, I think pre-pandemic. Pandemic was when the last set of guidelines came out, and there's been a couple of new things. This is a disease state where, you know, a lot of times we don't wait for the guidelines. I think there's a lot of disease states where nobody really jumps until the guidelines are released. You know, septic shocks, I think, a good example where, you know, there may be a study or two that shows, well, maybe we could do this, maybe we could do that. But I think everybody kind of waits until the Society of Critical Care Medicine comes out with their guidelines, and then they move or they don't move. This is not that case. I think when new studies come out that suggest, you know, this works, this doesn't, it seems to be adopted relatively quick. And maybe it's just because it's such a common disease state, and because it is a deadly disease state. So I was glad to see these updates. And so the guidelines are pretty much standard to the American College of Gastroenterology guidelines. They bring in a series of experts, and they have a medical librarian come with them. They ask a number of questions in PICO format. They then do a intensive literature search. They grade the evidence using the grade process from, you know, very high things like, you know, meta-analyses or randomized controlled trials, all the way down to case reports and retrospective studies. And then they either recommend something, which means you probably should do it. They suggest something, which means more often than not you should use it, or they recommend against something, which means you shouldn't do it. So it's and again, this is the same for I think pretty much all their guidelines. They note that again, this is pretty common, about 300,000 admissions annually in the United States for acute pancreatitis. So that ends up being a million patient days at a cost of over $2.5 billion. And it's they note that the incidence of acute pancreatitis is increasing, probably because of the increase in alcohol abuse, which is number one cause, but also because of the obesity epidemic, because one of the issues that comes with the obesity epidemic is gallstones, and gallstone pancreatitis is the number two cause. And there's some interesting new data that they talk about that I was certainly unaware of when it comes to the treatment and diagnosis of pancreatitis that we'll be talking about coming along here. The case fatality rate, I think, is generally decreased, but it's still a deadly disease. Somewhere around 10,000 people die every year in the United States due to acute pancreatitis. And it's usually not the pancreatitis itself. It's usually the overwhelming inflammatory sequelae, so organ failure, septic shock, ARDS, which I've seen many times, DIC, which I've seen several times. That's what usually ends up killing the patients, but it all starts with pancreatitis. And even if you take all that away, about 20% of patients who have acute pancreatitis go on to develop chronic pancreatitis. And again, for both inpatient and outpatient clinicians, they know it's one of the most frustrating diseases to treat for both the patients and the clinician, because these patients have terrible abdominal pain, they have serious nutritional problems, and it's extremely difficult to treat these patients. So if we can prevent the development of chronic pancreatitis by treating acute pancreatitis appropriately, I think that's something to think about as well. So, diving right into the guidelines, they spend a significant amount of time talking about the diagnosis of acute pancreatitis, and there's not a whole lot new here. I think most people who deal with this, see that, basically it's established by two of the three criteria. They have to have abdominal pain that's consistent with the disease, a serum amylase or lipase greater than three times upper limit of normal, and then characteristic findings from abdominal imaging, either a CT scan, a right upper quadrant ultrasound, something along those lines. They do note, interestingly, that abdominal pain is not always a severe in patients with acute pancreatitis. Sometimes it's actually fairly mild, and they may not even mention it. They may say, "Well, I got a little bit of discomfort there, but it's not too bad." That's not been my experience. Usually people end up in the hospital because they have severe abdominal pain. So I thought that was kind of interesting. They note that, of course, lipase is the test of choice. And again, all clinicians know that amylase just isn't sensitive or specific enough. They also note, though I haven't seen this done in a long time, you shouldn't follow serum lipases. When I came out of school 8 million years ago, when dinosaurs roamed the earth, we would follow serum lipases to see if patients were getting better. And there really is, there's no correlation to that. So don't do it. Just use it to establish the diagnoses. Keep in mind too, that lipases can be elevated by other things. DKA is the one that kind of jumps to my mind, where you're going to see a significant increase in serum lipase. They do suggest that in all patients, and this is one of the new recommendations, that in all patients with pancreatitis, even if you have a fairly good idea that, for example, it's alcoholic pancreatitis, that all patients with a pancreatitis should receive an abdominal ultrasound to evaluate for any biliary component. And I've seen that done, certainly, but not universally. If somebody comes in with a long history of pancreatitis, or a long history of alcoholism, excuse me, and this is their second, third bout of pancreatitis, we usually don't get a right upper quadrant ultrasound to see if they've got gallstones. It's like, oh, you have alcoholism, that's why you have pancreatitis. So that's pretty new. And the reason they do that is some new evidence suggests that we miss a biliary component of acute pancreatitis, even when there's another cause. And that, again, I was unaware of that. And so that's kind of a new thing that pretty much everybody who gets admitted to the hospital with pancreatitis, even if you're pretty sure of the cause, you should go ahead and get a right upper quadrant. They note that there are other causes besides alcoholism and biliary pancreatitis. Hypertriglyceridemia, if you can't find another cause, should be checked. Triglycerides should be checked. And if the numbers, if the level's above 1,000 milligrams per deciliter, that might well be your cause. Certainly, I've seen, overwhelming hypertriglyceridemia-induced pancreatitis with triglycerides in the tens of thousands. I'll never forget, and I tell this story all the time. A lot of my students and residents know this. Years ago, we had a patient who had a hypertriglyceridemia pancreatitis, had a triglyceride level of 20,000, and they drew blood initially from the patient. And with that kind of lipid in the blood didn't look red. The blood literally looked like a strawberry smoothie. And we were passing this vial of blood around, and it was just completely gobsmacking. I was like, how has this guy not had a stroke? I mean, that doesn't even look like blood. It was one of the most bizarre things I've seen in 30 years of being a pharmacist. So it was pretty weird. The other problem with hypertriglyceridemic pancreatitis is that the evidence is pretty clear that outcomes are worse. People do worse. Mortality is higher in patients with hypertriglyceridemia than they do from, say, alcoholism or gallstones. And so you do want to aggressively treat those patients. They don't go too much into detail on that, but this is definitely where plasmapheresis can play a role. And sometimes I think we pull the trigger on that a little late. Well, gee, let's see how they do with insulin infusions and the regular treatment for pancreatitis. I would argue that, especially if somebody has severe acute pancreatitis in the ICU and they have triglycerides above 1,000 and you don't have another cause, I would be sooner than later to start plasmapheresis on those patients because of the higher incidence of mortality associated with them. The other thing in my world when I see that is that, obviously anyone who has triglycerides that high, you want to make sure their blood sugars are under control if they have diabetes, but even so, they probably should be on, when they recover, fibrate therapy, fish oil. I'm usually pretty aggressive about treating, trying to keep their triglycerides below 500 because they've already demonstrated that they're going to have pancreatitis. So the other question that I get asked a lot about, of course, is drug-induced pancreatitis. And they note that a lot of drugs get attributed to drug-induced pancreatitis based on case reports or, something, my cousin cousin's friend's brother's sister's friend had had pancreatitis and they were on this drug. They note that there was a very recent classification scheme and review that some authors did that took a look at causation of drug-induced pancreatitis based on a classification system. And if you're an inpatient clinician, I would recommend, and we'll have a link to this in the show notes because it's free for the taking on the internet. A nice elegant a classification system about a causality where they start off with class one drugs, where there's high quality of evidence for causation of acute pancreatitis, usually from randomized controlled clinical trials, all the way down to class four, where it's basically just a few case reports. And they note that, probably, class four drugs, you might be able to say that it causes it, but I think you're kind of hard pressed to say that for sure. Whereas in, class one, two, and three, I think you could at least suggest that, yeah, this might be the cause if everything else fails. Of those drugs, it's worth note, that the class one drugs, the big one that I've certainly seen in my career is azathioprine and 6-mercaptopurine. Both of them are well known to cause pancreatitis, and so they're a class one. Class two drugs, ACE inhibitors, which again I've seen in my practice, as well as DPP-4 inhibitors and GLP-1 agonists. Keep in mind, they note that the GLP-1 agonists, the reason for pancreatitis in those patients may well be that with the rapid weight loss you see with those drugs, that you do develop gallstones, and that increases your risk of pancreatitis. So that might well be it. The immune checkpoint inhibitors, where basically those drugs for cancer cause every itis, right? So pneumonitis and pancreatitis and hepatitis. If it's an itis, those drugs basically cause it. SSRIs were listed as a class two, and don't think I've ever seen or recommend or suggested that SSRIs were a cause of acute pancreatitis, but they note that there is moderate quality of causation in acute pancreatitis with SSRIs. I had not known that before, and so I was kind of interested in that. Metronidazole and valproic acid were all class two as well. Everything else kind of falls away at that point. The only two other surprises I saw in this classification classification scheme is Bactrim, or trimethoprim sulfapoxazole, was a class 3B, which is basically, low level of evidence. I was taught that Bactrim is one of the most common causes of drug-induced pancreatitis, so that kind of surprised me. And the same with hydrochlorothiazide. Again, thiazide, as I was taught, is one of the more common drug cases of drug-induced pancreatitis. They actually classify that as stage 4. So I guess I'm going to be saying now that if someone has acute pancreatitis, we can't figure out a reason why, and they're on thiazides. It certainly, I guess, could be, but the evidence does not really suggest a causative factor there. So again, some surprises there. And again, especially for the pharmacist listening, a study or basically a review that I think is definitely worth taking a look at, because I had not seen that. So, and then the other thing they talk about that is relatively new is that there's growing evidence that suggests that tiny gallstones, what are called micro lithiasis, are the cause of iatrogenic acute pancreatitis in most of patients who have they've not found an etiology. And they note that even on imaging, it might be very, very difficult to see these teeny tiny stones. And because of that, they actually recommend, and again, this is new, that for a second episode of acute pancreatitis with no identifiable viable cause and patients fit for surgery, even if you don't have imaging evidence of gallstones or biliary sludge, they recommend performing a cholecystectomy. So basically, if you have a second bout, that you should probably consider having your gallbladder yanked. And I was, again, I had not heard that. That was pretty surprising. And again, it's just that they've noted that even in patients who have pancreatitis of another etiology, these microstones, which again are very hard to see on imaging, can play a role. And they note that there was a study that was published just a couple of years ago that looked in patients who had, after pancreatitis, had undergone cholecystectomy versus those who didn't, and found a significant reduction in recurrent pancreatitis in those patients, even if they had normal gallbladders, even if they didn't see stones or anything along those lines. And the number needed to treat was pretty impressive. Our treat was 5. And so again, I had not heard that. That's not something that I see a whole lot. And so that's something that I think is definitely worth thinking about in patients. Is, this is the second admission for pancreatitis. Even if their right upper quadrant is normal, do you consider getting surgery involved and having them take a look and see what's going on, basically? So they note that severe acute pancreatitis, as I pointed out earlier, is associated with all sorts of badness. Unfortunately, there is no easy early way to tell who's going to develop severe versus mild pancreatitis. Level of abdominal pain doesn't do it. CT imaging doesn't do it. And unfortunately, they've tried to come up with different and various schemes, looking at laboratory values and the physical exam, and nothing has really come up with it. They, of course, note that in organ failure, patients who have acute kidney injury, acute liver injury, or ARDS, they're obviously by definition going to have severe acute pancreatitis. They note that gastrointestinal bleeding is often missed in patients with acute pancreatitis, which, I mean, I've certainly seen before, but I never really connected the dots that GI bleeding be a sequelae of acute pancreatitis. So that was kind of interesting. So then we move on to treatment, which of course is my bailiwick. Again, when dinosaurs roamed the earth and I was in school, it was beat into my head that the treatment for acute pancreatitis is fluids, 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 and then when you're done, give them more fluids. And that, again, there's been some shift there. I mean, certainly intravenous fluid resuscitation is still, of course, the cornerstone of therapy for acute pancreatitis. The reason, of course, is that patients who have acute pancreatitis have marked endothelial injury. They have increased vascular permeability. And so that leads to third spacing of fluids, leads to intravascular depletion, which then, of course, leads to hypovolemia and organ damage. So, aggressive fluid resuscitation is still the cornerstone of therapy. And as many people know, the shift has been away from normal saline into lactated Ringer's. Again, not just for this, but septic shock and just about every other disease state where you need aggressive resuscitation. That lactated Ringer's is now preferred to normal saline and resuscitation and early aggressive hydration. There's been several benefits shown to LR, which includes a decreased risk of acute kidney injury, better electrolyte balance. They found that in laboratory studies that LR actually decreases systemic inflammation. I wasn't aware of that. It also provides calcium that binds ionically with fatty acids that are associated with severe disease and pancreatitis. And that lactate is in the ringer's lactate. It's also been shown to reduce pancreatic injury in animals, animal models. So again, kind of interesting. But then the second question, and this is something that again is kind of brand new, is how much? Because again, you know, we used to just blast people. I mean, even today, I think we just blast people with, you know, 250, 300, 500 mils an hour of LR. And so, you know, you know, the question is, do you need that much? You know, the thought's always been, well, you know, if I fluid overload them, I can always diuresis later. A recent study, and we actually reviewed this in a journal club in my hospital just I think last year, that looked at moderate intravenous hydration in the first 24 to 48 hours compared to aggressive hydration may actually have equal outcomes and cause much less fluid overload and things like that. And so they noted that in patients with mild to moderate pancreatitis, so these people weren't super severe, weren't in the ICU, stuff like that. They noted that an initial resuscitation rate of 1.5 mils per kilogram of body weight per hour is where you should be starting. And again, so 100 kilograms person, that's 150 mils an hour, much less than I have seen in aggressive resuscitation in these patients. However, they note that if the person looks hypovolemic, right, you know, they've been throwing up a lot, et cetera, that you can bolus them with 10 mils per kilogram, but then start at this kind of more conservative dosing approach. With severe disease, that the study that they reference in the guidelines don't really talk about that. They you know, say that those patients still might require more aggressive resuscitation, but they also note that there's a window for that. And if you don't complete your resuscitation goals in that first 24 hours, that resuscitation aggressively after that point has no benefit. And so they are actually pretty pointed in the guidelines, talking about that when someone comes in and you suspect severe acute pancreatitis, you know, the key is to really hit them hard in that first 24 hours. And then at that point, you can probably back them off because you're probably not getting any benefit. And again, they note that goal clinicians often miss the goal of failing to provide adequate hydration during the initial 24 hours when it is most important. So again, I think that the key there is that a mild to moderate pancreatitis, that we don't need to hit them with as many fluids as we used to, and that it will probably decrease fluid overload and the need for diuresis. But if they have severe pancreatitis, hit them hard in that first 24 hours, and then you can kind of back off after that. They note that antibiotics, and this isn't really a big change from the last set of guidelines, are not usually recommended in these patients. And that's always a tricky piece. Again, the clinicians, patient clinicians listening know, and they've all been in this situation before where, you know, a patient comes and they look septic because, you know, pancreatitis basically is the perfect example of the SIRS criteria, the systemic inflammatory criteria, without a bacterial infection, right? The reason that they have the SIRS criteria is not because they're infected, it's because of this overwhelming inflammatory response of pancreatitis. And so the immediate, knee-jerk response is, oh, we better start them on antibiotics. And they note that in the last 10 or 15 years, there's been a shift away from automatically using empiric antibiotics on all these patients. And I think we've done a better job at my hospital of not immediately hitting these guys with Zosyn or anything along those lines. But they note that even in patients with necrosis on their imaging, again, it used to be very common that we would hit these guys, and there was a bad, not very well done study in the 1990s that suggested that carbapenems were the treatment of choice for necrotic pancreatitis. There's really no evidence suggesting that it's any better than other, you know, broad spectrum, you know, Beta-lactam and beta-lactamase inhibitors. I mean, really, you just need to cover gram negatives and anaerobes like you would in any interabdominal infection. So, I mean, you know, ceftriaxone and metronidazole would be perfectly fine, I think, in most of these patients. But in any event, they note that necrosis does not automatically mean antibiotics. And so things get really tricky then, because it's like, at what point do you pull the trigger on antibiotics? And they note that there unfortunately is no easy test to say, okay, this person now has bacterial infection, unless they have something like positive blood cultures or things like that, not even fever, you know, because again, acute pancreatitis can cause fever. So they just basically recommend that if the patient has positive cultures, particularly positive blood cultures, that antibiotics are reasonable. And they do actually recommend, if the patient can tolerate the procedure, fine needle aspiration of an infected necrotic a pancreas to try and get an idea of the bugs that are leaded. I've rarely seen that done, at least in my hospital. But again, just to reiterate that antibiotics are usually not necessary in acute pancreatitis, even if they look like they have sepsis. keep in mind that pancreatitis in and of itself will cause that SIRS criteria. The other big change in the guidelines, and this is something that we've initiated in my hospital, but I have to admit there's been some resistance. And unfortunately, I've got a couple of, especially my intensivists, who are champions on this. And you know, again, the idea is about nutrition. And there's been a couple of big shifts talking about nutrition and pancreatitis. Again, a million years ago when I came out of school, we started these guys immediately on TPN as soon as they got diagnosed with pancreatitis, and then when they were able to eat, we converted them over to oral. And basically the whole point was you never gave anything by mouth to someone with pancreatitis, no food, because that would cause the pancreas to release more pancreatic enzymes and make things worse, et cetera, et cetera. There's now the evidence that suggests that, and even today, I do definitely see where, you know, the practices, you don't give them anything to eat until their pain is essentially gone, and then you can start oral feeding, and you usually start from like a clear liquid diet, and then kind of slowly move your way up and see how they tolerate it. So you don't start them off with a cheeseburger and fries. You know, you start them off with something pretty easy. But it's been noted that in the last 10 years, studies have suggested that that may not be the right thing to do, because feeding is good. Oral feeding maintains gut integrity. It prevents translocation of bacteria from the gut lumen into the necrosed pancreatic tissue, which theoretically then decreases the risk of infection. So the traditional, you know, let's not give them anything by mouth until basically they have no pain anymore, is really kind of fallen by the wayside. And they note that early oral feeding, 24, 48, 72 hours, without waiting for the pain to recede, or if you're following pancreatic enzymes, which you shouldn't, normalizing. They note that in fact, early oral feeding does not seem to be harmful, and in fact may actually be helpful in these patients. And I mean, as long as, again, they have bowel sounds present, they don't have significant nausea, vomiting, ileus, obviously those things would certainly stop you from feeding somebody orally. They note that several systematic reviews and meta-analyses have highlighted the benefit of early oral feeding in these patients, despite all types of pancreatitis, mild, moderate, and severe. Without and they also note that advancing the diet solely from clear liquids to a low-fat diet is not necessary. And so, you know, that what they suggest in the new guidelines is that you really should consider early oral feeding with a low-fat solid diet, which is shown to be safe compared to liquid diets. It provides more calories and is actually probably a good thing. So, you know, again, you know, that's a big shift away from what I was certainly taught, and I think up until the last couple of years was easily done. And really, the trigger whether you should start a diet on these patients is literally, are they hungry? If they say to you, "I'm hungry, I'd like to eat," it is reasonable to go ahead and start them on oral feedings, and again, a low fat solid diet, if they can, you know, swallow, is certainly reasonable to do. So again, that's a big shift, and a big paradigm shift, and I suspect will take a while for it to kind of, you know, settle in as the standard of care. In patients who have, you know, severe acute pancreatitis, who are in or septic, or and they basically can't tolerate regular oral feedings. Again, they note that TPN is not recommended anymore. The pendulum has completely swung the other way, away from TPN. That if at all possible, unless the patient basically has an ileus or a small bowel obstruction or something along those lines, that if you feed enterally versus parenterally, you have a decrease in infectious complications, organ failure, and mortality. So again, very different from what was taught when I came out of school. They note that continuous infusion tube feeds are preferred over cyclic or bolus admissions, and that if the patient doesn't tolerate traditional tube feeds, enteral formulas, that it's reasonable to use small peptide-based medium-chain triglyceride oil formulas that may improve tolerance. The last piece about nutrition is that, you know, even though we've been using more enteral routes, the thought was if we can place a feeding tube past the ligament of Treitz, where so basically it passes the point where the pancreas would release new pancreatic enzymes, that would be preferred. And they note that, however, you know, that's kind of fallen. I wouldn't say it's disfavorable, but there's been several small studies and a recent systematic review that suggests that nasogastric feeding. So basically the way we would feed everybody else who required enteral feeding is basically just as effective as nasojejunal feeding. So, I mean, again, if you can do NJ placement, that's reasonable, but they note that that's more difficult to do, that NG tube feeding is far easier and allows you to start feeding the patient a lot quicker. So they don't come right out and say it's absolutely recommended, but they note that NG tube feeding it may be preferred, and the fear of activating the pancreas and releasing more enzymes doesn't seem to be a reality. So the final thing that is not in the guidelines, but I'll talk just a bit about, is pain control, because of course these patients do have a lot of pain. And I think, what I'm seeing, at least in my practice, and certainly when I've talked to other colleagues, is, as kind of an outgrowth of our response to the opioid epidemic, we've really, really pulled back on using opioids on these patients. And, yes, we'll give them some PRN stuff and all that stuff, and that's fine. But I've definitely seen a fear of using opioids for acute pancreatitis, and I just don't think that's warranted. I think that acute pancreatitis is very painful. I think that it is absolutely reasonable to use opioids in these patients. Yes, you are going to put them at increased risk for ileus, because opioids cause pancreatitis, or I'm sorry, opioids cause constipation. And so, yeah, I mean, that's a bad thing, but I just don't think, I don't think it's ethical. I don't think it's the right thing to do to not be aggressive at pain control in these patients. Certainly you can use adjunctive therapy and stuff like that, but opioids really should be the mainstay of therapy for acute pancreatitis. Now, yes, sending them home on 100 of Vicodin or things along those lines, yeah, I wouldn't do that certainly. But I think in the house, while they've got really bad pain, I think this is we should not withhold opioids in these patients because of some fear of addiction or something like that. This is an acute syndrome. It's very painful, and I think that the right thing to do is treat these patients aggressively. So that's the new guidelines, Jen. It's again, a couple of new things and a couple of things that have really changed the paradigm on how we treat these patients. I'm fortunate in my hospital that we're doing some of this stuff, fortunately, because I have a couple of physician champions, but it'll be interesting to see where we go with this as time goes on.
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. It is such a great topic. And I appreciate your pain comments because, we've done so much on pain management, and I think everyone is so scared to, prescribe opioids and use those. But, your comment about the ethics of that and the true pain and what's really important in these patients, I think is a really good comment. So
I just, it's, I, you know, I, again, I, nobody wants to go back to the mid 90s,
Right.
I mean, and I get that, and, but like so many things in medicine, when something terrible happens, the pendulum swings all the way back
Right.
the other way. And I think we've overcompensated now. And, I think it is, again, this is a very painful disease. I would be very aggressive about treating these patients. So.
Yeah. And, we have to remember what those indications were for. It
Right.
was the fact that we overused was a whole different conversation. So, yeah,
Exactly
really,
correct.
really great point to end on. Such a good topic. I think it was a great way to celebrate our 4-year Game Changers anniversary. So, thank you.
No, thank you.
Our goal with this podcast is to have clinical conversations that keep you curious and up to date with drug therapy topics. We all need continued education to stay sharp, and our listeners tell us that hearing these quick topics and these deep dives that we do quickly each week, that Dr. Wall does such a fabulous job, and all the guests that we bring on is a game changer for their education and practice. So if you agree with that, we would ask that in honor of our anniversary, you share it with a friend or two or three this week. We'd really appreciate your support as we head into year 5 of our weekly podcast CE. It would truly help us grow and continue to bring these important topics to you. So thank you again, Jeff Wall, for sticking with us these 4 years
It's
and
been a
helping
lot of
us
fun.
grow this. I think we both had a vision when we started, and I think we've achieved that. So it'll be exciting to see what happens next.
I agree. Thank you, Jen.
Yeah, so fun. With that, that's it for this week. So if you are a CE plan member, be sure to claim your CE credit for this episode by logging in at ceimpact.com. And if not, if you're just here for the education, we appreciate that as well. As always, have a great week and keep learning. We'll talk to you next week.